Hello and welcome to Dialect for the week beginning Sunday the 9th of January 2011. I'm John Peters Colburn.
And I'm Michaela Dennis. This week,
Bristol Playgoers Club celebrates its centenary this year. We speak to the current boss. And we get the latest about Israeli apartheid and the siege of the Gaza ghetto from two people who just returned from the latest Bristol Gaza Link convoy. After that, a welcome relief from some of the woes of the world, we enter the comedy fringe and hear from comedian Mary Bork, as well as one of Richard Carey's Dredge Report podcasts.
Dialect is produced by volunteers and is broadcast in Bristol on BCFM 93.2, on Preston on 103.2 FM and in St Albans on Radio Verulam. If you want to get involved, contact Volunteering Bristol. They're just off Queen Square in Bristol, and we'll be giving more details about that at the end of the show.
One of the greatest occult writers of the 20th century is Dennis Wheatley.
The devil was part of the original creation, and if you believe in God, then you must believe in the devil. But, of course, that's nothing to do with Christian religion at all. There are two influences. One for light, under which everything grows and burgeons, blossoms, and one is darkness, in which everything decays and dies. And in any part of the world, within the year, the same hours of darkness and light supervene. And you have these two invisible influences striving for the soul of man. We don't know why, any more than we know what is eternity.
And you believe that light and darkness, right and left, good and evil, are two absolutely separate but equally powerful
warring powers. And the devil is only just a name for power of evil.
You referred just now to invisible influences. I'm perhaps a bit of a cynic, and I tend not to believe in these sort of things. Why do you believe in them?
Well, one invisible influence is, for example, the influence of the moon on the tides. There is good reason to suppose that all planets have an influence on us. Hypnotism, which has been proved again and again, telepathy, which is beyond dispute now, dowsing for water, they are invisible influences.
How did you first get involved in this interest?
Only because I was gassed in the First World War, so I had to give up tennis and all other outdoor sports. So I read enormously, and I read a great deal of fiction, but I also read accounts of Egyptology and all the ancient religions and so on, and became interested in that sort of thing. So when I had written three very successful thrillers, I was just simply looking round for a new form of excitement and so on. And it suddenly struck me, well, why not write a book about the black arts, Satanism? So I wrote The Devil Rides Out, and since then, although I've written 60 books, only 8 of my books have been about the occult, but they've all been very successful.
You say that today the powers of darkness in its eternal war, the power of darkness in its eternal war with the power of light, is threatening to come out on top. If this continues on an ever-increasing scale, the inevitable result will be a return to the brutal lawlessness, poverty, and insecurity of the Dark Ages. Do you really believe that about the modern
day? I do believe that. The violence and that sort of thing that's going on today is unbelievable, and the government are not controlling it. And that doesn't go only for this country. It's all over Europe and the United States worse than ever. And they've just got to take a line.
Well, give me an example of how the power of darkness, as you call it, is operating in this town, in this country today.
Well, there are said to be over 300 covens in this country. Covens, that is 13 people making up a coven of witches. And they're increasing every day, I suppose, because the two world wars have made great insecurity with young people, and they're looking for something, you must have something to cling on to, and they are tempted by these evil people, not necessarily people who have real power, but evil people, to come to these parties, who promise you want a medical boss, all right, you come along on Tuesday, you have a little fun and that sort of thing, and so on. And that is where an immense amount of dope pushing, that sort of thing, goes on, because witches and their sabbats have always used drugs.
Do you know, have you met modern witches?
When I first wrote my first book on black magic, before I wrote it, I took trouble to get an introduction to Aleister Crowley, to Rollo Ahmed, to Harry Price, Montague Summers, all of whom were top boys in that line. And I used to have them to lunch and dinner and talk to them. I had many conversations, but I've never dabbled into myself. I am absolutely certain no good can come of it, and you'll probably get so interested in this thing that you'll neglect your wife, you'll neglect your job, and there it is. If you're weak-minded, you can end up in a loony bin.
I wonder if you don't perhaps sometimes feel a sense of responsibility yourself for the state of affairs, because there is no doubt your books sell in absolutely fabulous numbers. About Bagman. Are you catering for the very thing that you are against?
I can't believe that, because in every book I write, I always give a warning that this thing is evil and no good can ever come to anybody who dabbles in it.
You haven't quite answered my question. Aren't you feeding the curiosity that is creating this evil?
No, I don't. I feel that by warning people, so many people are drawn into this thing, and I feel that I, at least, am in warning them. It's not a good thing to do.
Do you think they might ever strike at you?
No, I have complete confidence in my own protection, because they can only strike at people who are afraid and who believe that they can be harmed. And I don't. I don't say that I'm a particularly good person, but I believe that I'm on the right side. And I believe the powers of light will protect me from anything that anybody could ever attempt about me.
But you're fearful the powers of darkness may take us over.
I think that civilization is disintegrating. Unless somebody takes a pull, things are getting worse and worse every year.
And that was Dennis Wheatley there.
Don't feel the reason.
Eagle-eared listeners will have noticed in the past that we do take an interest in things to do with Gaza, and the Bristol-Gaza link have been in before regarding convoys that have taken place going a variety of ways, either across Europe or via boat or across North Africa to get to Gaza in order to give them aid. Well, this week is no exception. They've returned from the Bristol-Gaza convoy with their aid. We have two guys in here who've been there in person, and we're going to chat to them now. Well, it's my pleasure to introduce to the studio Keith Darkin and Shahid Iqbal. Hello.
Hello.
The reason you're here is because you have returned safe and sound from the convoy to Gaza. So well done for coming back. Seeing as these things are always incredibly difficult, we had Sunette on to chat about the journey. So eagle-eared listeners will be aware of some of the things that happened there. Understand that the journey was very difficult. In brief, you know, how did you find the journey? How long did it actually take you to get there?
Well, we were supposed to be in Gaza on the third weekend, and we actually got to Gaza on the seventh weekend. So we spent a month waiting in one place or another within Libya, trying to get a connection through to actually arrive in El Arish in Egypt, and then from thence to go to Gaza.
Right. How many people did you manage to pick up en route? Because you just seemed to pick up quite a few.
Well, about,
quite keen.
About 30, I think it was, travelled by plane to Tripoli and met us there.
Okay.
And I think our numbers were then up to about 125, something like that.
Okay, so what was your experience of Egypt specifically?
Terrible.
Yes.
We got to the land border, couldn't get through. The Libyans wouldn't allow us to actually move up to the border, I found out today. I thought it was the Egyptians, but both the Libyans and the Egyptians were not interested in allowing us through the border from Libya to Egypt.
Yeah.
I mean, unfortunately, the Egyptians are actually complicit in the blockade that surrounds Gaza. After the Mavi Marmara attack on back in May, they promised to allow all humanitarian aid convoys to pass by land through the through the land border between Libya and Egypt.
And they've reneged on that.
Yes.
Right, okay. So how did you? Okay, but you did get through in the end. We're pleased to say. Who were you met by when you get there? What is it when you turn up?
Rapturous crowds. We got there about maybe 12 o'clock at night. Was it quite late?
Between 12 and 1. Yeah.
Is there street lighting there when you turn up?
Not really. Not to speak of really. You could see well enough, but the crowds were tremendous. There were probably about 10 deep, I think, for about 200 yards, something like that.
Yeah,
and very, very happy to see us.
Yeah, we got a really warm welcome all the way from the border, all the way into the town, really. I mean, you could see sort of the Hamas sort of guards just sort of emerging from the shadows as we went by, and they were really friendly as well, and we didn't feel threatened at all by anybody. It was, it was completely not what I expected, what the media sort of portrays as, Hamas as evil rebels. These guys are just volunteers, they're there helping and trying to make the best of a bad situation. And we could see that from the moment we entered there.
Right. What is it like, sort of architecturally? I mean, in my mind, I've just got pictures of sort of rubble everywhere, basically, and, sort of an absolute disaster area. Am I sort of on the mark there?
Well, the Americans and the British came in and actually cleared up a lot of the rubble, as part of a PR campaign almost, which is quite disgusting because you can't actually see any of the devastation. It's meant so that when people from the outside world visit Gaza, that they don't see the chaos and destruction. And also it seems to encourage the possible future building of settlements, which is even more disturbing.
How so?
Well, if there's a flat land, then it's easier for these raids to develop, and if they get their hands on it, basically.
Okay.
But essentially, around the city of Gaza, we kept on seeing bullet holes, tank shells in many of the buildings. Many of the structures were just completely destroyed. And from when we were taken around the actual governmental buildings that were destroyed, it wasn't just local projects that were attacked. It was actually international projects that were attacked. The British, French, Canadian, and Spanish governments actually helped to create a governmental office so they could operate from, treating them like a legitimate government.
Okay.
Which is what they needed. And And basically, that was just Bond. They just sent the clear message out that no one can build on Palestinian soil.
So what sort of governmental authority do they manage to operate in Gaza?
Well, they... I mean, Hamas obviously taken over. They've had to actually restore some kind of order. I mean, the governmental departments still operate, but they, instead of having an actual department, they're all operating out of one building in small office spaces, as opposed to actually having the amount of space that they need to function as a government. But they still manage with what they have.
Okay.
I mean, they're quite resilient people and very, very resourceful. So really? I mean, they take what they have and they use what they have very, very efficiently.
So how do they manage to make any money, these people who live there? What do they do? I mean, fisheries would be one main source of income, but I understand that's now restricted.
Yes, it's part of the ongoing blockade. There's a fishing blockade, which is up to 3 kilometres. I mean, this is actively destroying the ecosystem in the area, because fishes are actually having forced to be caught at a very young age. So the fishes that have been caught are smaller and smaller and smaller, and the area is actually becoming a dead zone. I mean, there's no the fishing industry is nearly dead as well, not just because of the blockade, but also because there's a whole bunch of derelict boats in the harbour, which I mean, part of the Israeli blockade is not allowing any parts to enter, so they can't actually get the necessary parts they need to fix the boat so they can go out and fish.
So, well, I suppose this brings us to the aid that was in the convoy. What sort of aid were you taking through, Keith?
Medical and educational aid, plus a few other bits and pieces.
Okay, do you get that?
The main point of the aid, though, is not the aid itself, but the fact that the Palestinians themselves say that the main point of the thing that they're interested in, as far as convoys is concerned, is for the people to come there to see what's happening and to bring the stories back home, to tell people here, friends, family, and the media, what's going on in Gaza, you know. I mean, the aid is valuable, but it's a very, very small part of what they need.
Okay.
And in fact,
do you get that sort of examined on the way through? You know, they sort of, what exactly are you?
Well, we've had to give manifests for what was inside the vehicle, but
right.
They could be very brief. They're not, essentially, they're not interested in seeing what we've got. They weren't searching for weapons, for instance. They would accept this manifest at its face value.
How long were you in Gaza when you were here?
Only 3 days. That's a matter for the Egyptian government as to where how long you stay. Sometimes it's only a day.
Right.
They gave us 3 days, which was very generous in their time. And there was quite an organised programme about what we did during that time.
Okay.
The first day,
so it's all like an itinerary.
Demolition. And although a lot of it had been cleared away, you could still see severe damage to the buildings which were still standing.
Okay, and they managed to sort of repair these in some sort of...
No, there's nothing they can do about it, because the only cement they get is what they make themselves by crushing rocks.
You can get shot at whilst doing that.
Did you feel physically endangered while you were there?
Not really. I heard an F-16 go over, but I didn't see it. We were in a hotel, actually, on the beach, more or less, and I heard the sound of an F-16 go off. And I asked the guy that works on the... on the counter for the kitchen, is that an F-16? And he said, yes, it is. And apparently they go across on a regular basis on a Tuesdays and Fridays or something like that, just to show the people that, you know, that
we are here.
We're here. And the same goes for the gunboats. They're always patrolling outside that 3 kilometre limit.
Okay.
But in fact, if they go more than 2 kilometres, they're still liable to be shot at. And the buffer zones for the land, the farmers, they're about 500 metres, I think. But if you go within a kilometre of the boundary, actual boundary, then you're still liable to be shot at.
Okay,
you can get regularly shot at.
And have you both been before, or is this your first convoy?
This is my first one.
This is the first one. Okay, and Shahid?
Mine too.
Okay, how old are you, Shahid?
24.
24, wow. I'm trying to think, would I have been that brave at 24, I don't know. So what do you think is the main sort of priority? I mean, you know, if the conflict's going to continue, how are these people coping? What do they need in order to cope?
Well, they need a complete political, which isn't going to happen overnight, but they need a complete political solution to it. The American and the British governments should not be giving them money, should not be buying them arms. The Americans are giving the Israelis $3 billion a year, I think.
Yeah. I mean,
like
you know, they're very resilient people, but if the conflict... If they are a very resilient people, but if the conflict continues, this can't go on, they can't cope indefinitely.
Well, it's called ethnic cleansing. There's a very good book on the subject called The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine by Ilan Pape.
Ilan Pape.
Yeah, P-A-P-P-E.
Okay.
He's an Israeli who... has given a very, very good history. I think it's a definitive history of the history of Palestine since the beginnings of Zionism as an intellectual idea, if you like, although that's putting too grandiose a title on it. In the 1890s, it goes right through the Nakba, the so-called catastrophe in 1948.
I don't know if this is
when they displaced about 750,000 Palestinians from their land. They've stolen about 75% of the original Palestine.
How can people communicate with people in Palestine without actually physically going there? Well, I kind of assume they don't really have internet as such.
They do. A lot of them communicate through Facebook. I didn't realise how many of them do, but there's hundreds of people out there. I mean, and what the Palestinians need most of all is just for people to know that they're not this kind of backward sort of stereotypical associations that we have with Arab culture. They do not apply to these people. I mean, these people are very cosmopolitan. I mean, in some respects, they're quite conservative, but also there's a lot of creative enterprises going on there. There's a lot of artists. There's a very much a thriving art scene there.
Right.
There's local drama groups for people. In fact, I'm looking at getting involved with a young drama group called the Young Journalist Club. Based in central Gaza. They have like a theatre and they have a radio show. And what we're looking at doing is creating a form of trade that actually goes beyond the blockade, one that they actually can't police, which is through the internet.
Right.
What I'm proposing to do is to get films sent over, and then we show them here, and we use the entrance fees or suggested donation to plough money back into their projects. It's called the Young Journalist Club, and basically they help young orphans from the 2008 war. War implies two fighting sides, it's more of an attack.
Yeah.
I mean, we met a bunch of people who've been very, very badly affected by it. One girl had lost 27 members of her family.
Okay.
Another boy he was attacked with white phosphorus, which is illegal under UN guidelines. It's completely inhumane. It actually burns down to the bone. This kid was
But they managed to help him.
Well, I suppose you can't help someone who's blinded.
Yeah.
You know, he's completely blind. But at the same time, they allowed these children to express themselves and to really clear the air, which is what is desperately needed.
So he's able to sort of communicate and express himself in some way.
They encouraged him to talk about what's happened to them. Yeah,
well, sort of ran out of time, unfortunately. I wanted to talk about that a lot more, but I'm sort of hurrying to the air.
Yeah.
And if people want to find out more about Bristol Gaza Link, how can they do that? They just sort of stick Bristol Gaza Link in Google. That will just sort of bring up an appropriate website.
Yes, I'm sure it will.
I'm sure it will. Yeah. Okay. Well, Keith and Shahid, I'm very sorry to cut you short there, but I'm afraid we've run out of time. But thank you very much for coming in, and we look forward to hearing more about future convoys in the future.
Yeah. Thank you.
The Avon Association of Drama helped coordinate all the semi-professional drama groups in and around Bristol, and the first dramatic excursion of this year is happening at Newman Hall, Grange Court Road on Westbury and Trim, at 7:30 on Tuesday evening. That's the 11th of January. And I'm joined now on the phone by David March, who's president of the group that's putting on the play on the 11th of January, the Bristol Playgoers Club. Hi there, David.
Hello.
Hello. So what play are you putting on then?
Well, we're doing two one-act plays on Tuesday next.
Okay.
We're doing a play by David Mamet called Reunion, with David Mamet being an American author, very well known, has done some fantastic plays. This is just a one-man, one-woman play.
Okay.
Father and daughter who meet each other for the first time, which sounds almost ridiculous, but of course it's not necessarily. And they see each other for the first time for over 20 years. It's a remarkable play and a serious play and well worth seeing. The second one is a complete contrast in that it's a play called Hands Across the Sea by Noel Coward, which shows how much of a contrast it is.
Absolutely.
And we like doing things like that, having contrasting one acts, or throughout our season, which runs from September to April, we try and do contrasting plays, plays of all to suit all tastes, so to speak, because we have a wide-ranging membership, of about 120 people. And we can't please everybody all the time, obviously.
No, of course not.
There you are.
So tell us a bit more about the Bristol Playgoers Club. You've said there's over 100 members. I mean, that's a fairly strong showing. How long's the club been going?
Well, as it so happens, 2011 is our centenary. We were founded in 1911. And so we have a next year, our next season is going to be our centenary season, the season 2011-2012. And we essentially these days produce rehearsed readings fortnightly through the season from September to April. And we, as I say, we have a very varied type of play throughout the season. We have 120 members. Because we don't compete, we don't do a full production. We just do rehearsed readings, which work extremely well and have done for many, many years. In fact, for the best part of 100 years. We are able to do plays which normally dramatic companies couldn't do because they're not necessarily financially feasible.
Sure, because of all the props and, costumes and things like that, perhaps.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So we do about a dozen plays a season, as I say, fortnightly. We're now in the second half of this season. And if I just let you know what we're doing for the rest of this season.
Yes, please, yep.
25th of January, we're doing a play called Thark, a famous Ben Travers farce. After that, we're doing The Accrington Pals by Peter Whelan, First World War play. After that, we're doing what was famously done at the tobacco factory, The Wills Girls, or Wills's Girls, I should say, shouldn't I, by Amanda Whittington. After that, we're doing an Arthur Miller called The Price. That's followed by David Auburn's Proof, another American play. And we're completing the season on the 12th of April with Under Milkwood by Dylan Thomas.
Well, that is certainly quite an agenda to be getting through. If people want to get in touch, David, how can they get in touch with you?
Well, they can get in touch with me. Would you like my telephone number?
That would be fantastic.
Which is 01275 372422. We welcome new members.
Fantastic. David March, president of Bristol Playgoers Club, which is celebrating its first 100 years in 2011, thank you very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you for having me.
Last month, we heard from the veteran of Comedy 365 on the internet and 404 Funny, which is a reference to the error screen that you get on computers and on the internet as well, podcaster Richard Cray. This week, we hear one of Richard's five-minute downloadable comedy podcasts, part of a series called The Dredge Report, he put together last year in a week of producing 5 minutes of comedy a day.
Mules. How many of you have seen or indeed heard a mule today? Well, don't worry, because today's episode of The Daily Dredge includes more mules than we know what to do with. So sit back, relax, deactivate Atronalyze, and listen to the show. My name seems to be John Dredge, and presenting the programme with me today is, in fact, a mule called Nigel. Hello, Nigel.
Hello, Johnny. It's great to be here.
My goodness me. Two presenters. This is a bit like The One Show, isn't it? Except this programme is good. Any road, today's Daily Dredge includes bicycles, rice paper, and a 3-ounce tin of armchairs into the bargain. Or does it? But first, it's competition time, and today's question is, how many wigwams are there in a container, generally speaking? When you think you know the answer, sellotape your entry to a passing mule and point it in the direction of our Frinton studios. And the first correct mule to arrive wins our star prize of another mule. Or is it? And now let's take some of your calls, because it's time for our special phone-in competition. And on line one, we have a Mr. Hamish McScottish Stereotype. Hello, Hamish.
Hello, John. It's great to be here. Or is it?
You took the words right out of my mouth, Hamish, which was rather unhygienic, it has to be said. Now, Hamish, are you ready for the competition?
Is that the question?
No, Hamish, the competition's coming up right now. Hamish, I've just put an object on the Daily Dredge mantelpiece. Can you guess what it is from a series of clues? Well, let me give you the clues first. Clue number one, it's not a bat.
Is it a bat?
It's not a bat. Now listen carefully to clue number two. It's not a cup.
Is it a cup of bats?
No. Now, Hamish, listen to the third clue. Here it is now. It's not a... Oh dear, that item seems to have exploded. So in the meantime, here's some music. And now on the Daily Dredge, it's time for Thought for the Day with the Reverend Stockton Mame.
This week I was preparing my sermon when I noticed a piece of cheese in my kitchen. On further inspection, I noticed that it was very old indeed and smelt rather unpleasant. And this got me thinking about the Bible, because the Bible is very old, isn't it? And yet, despite this, it never goes off.
That was the last thought for the day from the Reverend Stockton Mame, because he is terrible. And now it's time for the weather forecast with our old friend, and I use the term loosely there, partially acclaimed avant-garde film director, Mr. David Lynch. Hello, David.
Hello, John. Or at least that's what I would say if I was able. Today's weather will be varied, with many cloud formations occurring in the sky. The ground will remain normal, with fish in the sea and mules in the lake.
Allegedly, that was the weather with David Lynch. Will he be back tomorrow, David?
Only with the proviso that you convert the studio into a fully operational chip shop.
Well, thank you, David Lynch, or to be more accurate, go away. Now, we've just had a text from one of our mules, Mr. Derek Listener of Lurganshire, and he says, could you play the sound of a mule being fired out of a giant catapult for my wife, Shillelagh, who's 60 today? So just for you, here it is. I hope that brings back some happy memories. And here's an unusual text from Boris Clankton of Skegness, who says, I'm enjoying the show, but would it be possible to end it now, as I've got to go out? Well, Boris, this is for you. Good night.
That was The Daily Dredge, written and performed by John Dredge and a mule. The producer was Richard Cray and a mule. Or is it?
Richard Cray's Dredge Report there, following up on the interview we did with him in December about how to do a comedy podcast that could set you on the road to a career in comedy. And as Richard said, because national comedy has gone rather stale nowadays, it could be the best time to use your comic talent. Like this brilliant piece from the brilliant but rarely seen Mary Bork.
Every time you ring up the bank, they always ask security questions like, what's your mother's maiden name or your place of birth, your most memorable address? Now, I don't know if you know this, but you can actually create your own security question, which is exclusive to you and can only be answered by you. So every time I ring up the bank, they have to ask me the following. Miss Burke, what are you wearing? To which I have to respond, you filthy, disgusting pervert. I want to speak to your supervisor. Then we have a bit of a laugh, I check my balance and everybody's happy. If you're ever doing a comedy gig in Midtown Manhattan and the room is full of US Marines who've just returned from Iraq, it's probably best if you don't open up with the line, you know, speaking as a historian, I think it's wrong to compare George Bush to Adolf Hitler. Because Hitler wrote a book. And he was democratically elected. Then I had to leave the gig by the back door surrounded by bouncers like I was Ricky Hackin in Las Vegas.
That was stand-up Mary Bork there. Keep an eye out for her. You can find out more from Richard Cray at comedy365.com and not forgetting 404funny.co.uk. And most importantly, have a go, there's room at the top. Don't forget Julius's free day and night. Night is called Day and Night, somewhat confusingly, Bristol Comedy Fringe Club Night on St Nicholas Street in Bristol on the first and last Thursdays of the month, 7:30 in the evening. Tis my pleasure to introduce the Bard of Windmill Hill, Trevor Carter. Hello.
Hello, John.
Happy New Year to you, and, well, you have an event, I understand, first of all, before you launch the event.
Yes, this is going to be taking place today at 8:30.
Mm-hmm. This is, in case we're listening to a repeat, that's Sunday the 9th.
Sunday the 9th, yes. At 8:30, the Victoria Park Pub.
Okay, where is that?
Which is 66 Raymond Road.
Okay.
Near Victoria Park, Windmill Hill. Windmill Hill area. It goes under various names.
Home territory for you then?
Yes, it's the other side of Windmill Hill.
So what sort of an event?
It's a mini cabaret featuring myself and Darren Hoskins, who's going to be doing comedy storytelling.
Okay.
So it's a free event. VAT free, completely free.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's it.
Well, give us a taster of your style, how you roll. What have you got poetry-wise?
Well, it's going to be mostly love poetry, aspects of love.
Mm.
Yeah. I probably won't do this one. This is a kind of anthropomorphic poem, love poem. If you and I were dolphins.
Mm-hmm.
If you and I were dolphins, we would swim nude together while talking telepathically to show that we are clever. Dolphins are intelligent. They know much more than us. That's why when people see them, they always make a fuss. If you became a dolphin, I think you'd be all right. You'd fit in as a dolphin, as you are really bright. But if I became a dolphin, my prospects would be grim, because I'm really silly, and also, I can't swim.
And as Douglas Adams reminded us just before the universe ended, a surprisingly complicated attempt, or so we thought, by dolphins to jump backwards through a hoop and whistle the Star Spangled Banner was actually them saying, so long, and thanks for all the fish. Trevor Carter, thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
And when was the, say that once again, it's at the which pub?
The Victoria Park.
The Victoria Park?
Raymond Road.
Raymond Road.
I'll give you the postcode just in case anybody wants to look it up to find it. It's BS3HQW.
Brilliant, thank you very much. Yeah. Sharp-minded and obsessive listeners to the show, of which we have many millions, will remember a previous guest we had on the show named Bridget White. She came in to chat about religion and Catholicism in Ireland, etc., but she's come back in again to read us a poem. So without further ado, over to Bridget.
Well, I've written about 30 poems, and I wrote this one over 20 years, about 20 years ago.
Right.
And the title is Such Love from On High.
Okay.
Yes, shall I?
Yeah.
Worldly love will come and go as surely as the ocean waters flow. It will have its ups and downs, turn you up and twist you all around. This love is not very strong, and more often it doesn't last very long. It takes you to a height, and then you drop like a deflated kite. But the love I have just for you is gently, meekly flowing through, as naturally as the ocean waters do. It comes down from on high. It's truthful and without a lie. It cares for you when you are here or there. It always remembers and never forgets, and nothing in return it expects. It lasts forever and a day, whether here or there. It watches you from afar and near. It's without jealousy and fear. It sees your inner hurt and pain and wants to comfort you time and time again. It sees your inner conflicts and emotions that are so deep, deep as the oceans, where an earthly love cannot reach and only love from on high can teach. Where did I find such love just for you that is so humble and true? It's a gift from God, not for me, but for you. And in return, you would see his love just for you.
Well, thank you very much. And as ever, we always have poetry every week. So if you like that, there'll be more in coming weeks.
So John Peters Coleman is going to take a break now. I'm Anthea Page, and I'm here to tell you about the recent rally in the Forest of Dean. Forest of Dean community is alarmed at the prospect of the government selling off the Forest of Dean. Hands Off Our Forest, or HOOF, is the campaign group fighting the proposals. It is a broad alliance of groups and individuals, and many people are asking what the consequences of a sell-off will be for the Forest of Dean and its community. Uncertainty will remain for some time unless the bill is amended. The present coalition government is pushing through a public bodies bill that will, according to the minister, fundamentally reform the public forestry estate, with diminishing public ownership and a greater role for private and civil society partners. The bill is being rushed through Parliament this winter and may receive assent in the middle of 2011. This means selling Forestry Commission land, including the Forest of Dean. So we go over now to the forest to hear a speech made by the Bishop of Guildford. This was recorded by Alex Mill.
Why the hell is the Bishop of Guildford here? Because 4 years ago, my wife and I bought, or were buying still on a mortgage, a house in Ruadeen. And so we're residents, and that's why we're here. But I can say that the Bishop of Gloucester, my colleague and brother, sends his greetings today and his full support for HOOF. So, may I make some reference to something already that's been spoken about several times, the 1981 debate and the 1981 amendment exempting the forest. In the House of Lords, the proposal for the amendment by Lord McNair passed, and all the arguments that were used, I think, just 30 years ago are still completely valid today in the terms of the Forest of Dean. And the then member for the Forest of Dean, Paul Marland, who argued in the Commons that any legal standing or rights of the public or commoners had actually been abolished way back in 1808 by the Dean and the New Forest Act of Parliament. He said, if the forest is sold, there will be no forest paths, no picnic sites, no sheep, because they do not enjoy legal status. In their place, there will be high fences, keep out notices. Now, Baroness Royal's already referred to some more recent legislation, which she's a bit rightly, in my view, suspicious of in terms of really changing that. The government of the day then, 81, changed its mind, accepted the Lord's amendment, and then the government spokesman in the House of Lords said the Forest of Dean is unique and that the land should not be sold. The amendment will therefore maintain the status quo. And that is why I shall be supporting the amendment that Baroness Royal's already spoken of, which will be coming up later this month in the House of Lords. The point being made by the former member for the Forest of Dean is not just historical. Assurances about the sale of parts or the whole of the forest not affecting long-standing privileges and access and use have no protection in law because they've long since to exist as legal rights, rightly or wrongly. Either you have to have extremely elaborate and legal protections now to be constructed in the future, put in place, and that will, of course, economically considerably reduce the value of the money for the sale of the land, or, much more sensibly, much more simply, replace the exemptions that are in place now in the new bill. I want to add something now by way of a cautionary tale. Forest is unique. I come originally from the West Midlands, and when I go to the top of the hill at Ruadeen, I can look over and see the Malverns, sometimes Clee Hill, hills I could see from the other side as a boy. In that part of the world, anciently there was the Forest of Mercia. That's long since gone, centuries and centuries ago.
Now the National Forest is being planted in dribs and drabs in Nottinghamshire, in Staffordshire, in Derbyshire. Little separate woodlands. The National Arboretum near Lichfield, a wonderful project, but the trees are that high. It will be 150 years before we see anything of that, and it'll still be little parcels of land. There'll be little woods, not a forest. Other parts of England, stressing that the Forest of Dean is unique, other parts of England, look at Lancashire, the Forest of Bowland. It's mostly beautiful valley. There is still some woodland. Look at my own part of the world where I work now as Bishop, Surrey, some extensive woodlands on the North Downs. Anciently, the whole of Surrey and Sussex was woodland, but the iron industry, yes, believe it or not, the iron and steel industry in Sussex in the Middle Ages denuded the woods because of charcoal. The Forest of Dean is unique. Some similarities with the New Forest in Hampshire, though that is also very extensively heathland now, it was forest, but the Forest of Dean has had its ups and downs. We've spoken about the 1981 possibilities, but there have been two times in the fairly recent history in which the forest nearly came to grief. Iron was mined and smelted, as we know, from Roman times. In the 17th century, there were the king's ironworks in the forest and other furnaces. But both Oliver Cromwell and Charles II, two very unlikely coalition partners, if I may say so, suppressed the ironworks because what they were doing to the forest. Timber, which was needed then for the navy and for the mercantile fleet, was being taken down far too quickly. And reforestation was established by Act of Parliament. In 1668, an Act of Parliament actually spoke of the forest becoming totally destroyed. That was probably an exaggeration, but an Act of Parliament spoke of the forest almost depleted in those days. A century and a half later, Lord Nelson came to look at the Forest of Dean. Again, he had concern about wood, mature timber for the ships, for the navy, and he wrote a pretty negative report. Forest husbandry in those days was not managed well, and many individuals, no doubt making a bit of profit, were cutting down immature trees and wasting timber. Go to the little museum in Monmouth and see Nelson's diaries and his reports on the Forest of Dean. My point is a very simple one. At least twice in the last 400 years, the forest has almost been destroyed because of individualistic, uncontrolled, unmanaged economic forces. Now, this is not a rant against industry in the forest. Industry is important in the forest. The forest itself is an industry. But under the Crown and later the Forestry Commission, industry in the 18th, 19th and the 20th centuries was properly regulated and managed as a whole, not in individual parcels. The coal mines of the forest were huge enterprises giving work most of the time to many. Not an easy life for miner. Read Winifred Foley's stories of her mining father in the hard days of the 30s. Stone quarrying still continues in the forest. Now there's also, hugely important, the tourist industry in the forest. But such industries have never been allowed to destroy the forest or destroy its integrity as a whole. The likelihood of individual parcels of the forest being sold off is very high indeed if this bill is unamended. This will destroy the integrity and the wholeness of the forest and its amenities for all of us, whether newcomers like myself, whether tourists for the day or on holiday, or for the foresters born and bred here. So we need to support this campaign so that the Forest of Dean can continue to flourish for another 400 years and more.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Bishop of Guildford, the Reverend Christopher Hill.
Why have you stolen our earth?
Nobody told us how much it was worth. We want to make up for that now.
That was recorded by Alex Mill in the Forest of Dean. And next week you'll hear more about the campaign to save the forest.
Next up, it's my pleasure to introduce Jeff Sparks with his What's On Guide. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Michaela. Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect, starting with Friday, 14th of January, and Private Dicks will be performing at the Prom Bar in Gloucester Road, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is free. Moving into Saturday, 15th of January, and Crowbar will be performing with support at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £13.50 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I present Bellowhead. This is from their latest album, Hedonism, and there's a track titled Little Sally Racket.
Little Sally Racket, she wore my best jacket, and she lost a ticket. Little Daisy Dawson, she got battle drawers on, so she's out of Bolson, to be whore in Hilo.
That was Bellowhead with Little Sally Racket from the latest album Hedonism. Now Bellowhead will be performing as one of the headliners at the Bristol Folk Festival from 29th of April to 1st of May at the Colston Hall in Bristol. Early bird weekend tickets are £60 each and the offer runs out on 31st of January and then weekend tickets will cost £75 each. For more info check out www.bristolfolkfestival.co.uk. Keeping with 15th of January, Steve Payne will be performing at the Prom Bar in Gloucester Road, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. Finally, on Sunday, 16th of January, The Balance will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. The gig starts at 4 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Nice one. Thanks, Jeff.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 12 noon every Sunday. And is broadcast also in Preston on 103.2. Also, not forgetting, of course, Radio Verulam in St Albans. If you're outside Bristol and on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Thursday evening when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from our website, dialectradio.co.uk.
You can also find a lo-fi mono version of Dialect for Dialect Connections at bristol.indymedia.org. And indie is with a Y. And that's going out every Friday morning. So thank you to our guests today. We had Tony Gosling, Andrew Tyler and David March. We also had The Dredge Report and Mary Bork. And not forgetting, of course, Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill and Jeff Sparks. Studio production this week was by Mike Noyce and the producer was Tony Gosling. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to do so, then please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, which you can find also on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect and I've been Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman, wishing you a very good week from all the team in Queen Square Studio in Bristol City Centre. Thank you very much for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye.
You say it best when you say